AI is making waves in every field it touches. President Biden is now on TikTok, and the election draws closer each day. With so much going on in the world, it is hard to keep up with it all, let me tell you. Hi, I'm Kai Ryssdal, the co-host of Make Me Smart. It's a podcast from Marketplace. And every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I break down the latest in business and the economy with short daily episodes to make it easy for you to stay in the know. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.
Vincent, So I hear tell that you once got Ripley'd.
I did.
Do you want to share the story with us?
I do.
Okay.
One day.
Yeah.
When I first started doing theater criticism as my job. So
okay.
I'm like, you know, I'm still getting used to the rhythm of going to the theater all the time and like the insane luxury of, you know, getting there and somebody standing there with an envelope with your name on it.
Feels good.
It feels great. And I get to the theater and I say, Vincent Cunningham, as one does, to get their press tickets. And the woman looked at me and says, Vincent Cunningham's already here.
What?
Chills.
I gave him, Vincent Cunningham, his tickets. And I said, no, you did not.
And you
I'm Vincent Cunningham.
You whip out your ID.
I whipped out my ID.
Yeah.
she just puts me in a seat at the back of the orchestra. But I know where I'm supposed to be sitting.
Sure.
I walk over to where my seat should have been. And when I get there, there are two people, one of whom is a guy who looks just like me.
You're kidding me.
Yeah. Like sort of medium complected black dude with glasses.
No.
And
that's
like
so creepy.
Even like little moles around the sides of his eyes like I have. And I looked at him and I didn't know what to do. And he had the nerve to bring a date.
I can't believe he brought a date.
So, okay, like, and of course, the possibilities are rifling through my mind.
It's bold.
Knows that I'm a theater critic and
he knows what
realizes
you look
that
like.
He looks like me and decides that this gives him an opportunity to go to the theater sometimes.
And I'm sorry, he knew what play you were seeing when. There are various press dates for plays. It is no guarantee that you were showing up then.
It still doesn't make any sense.
That is, to me, the eeriest part.
I have no idea what's happening. All I know is that I have this, like, sort of unsatisfying conversation with him. It's like, did you use my name? Did you say Vincent Cunningham to get these seats? Like, what's going on? So we have this situation where, like,
what did he say?
I'm trying to be, like, confrontational, like, slightly macho. And he's like, no, what are you talking about? What?
Right.
Why would you come over to me? Blah, 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 blah. Like, of course, like, there's no direction in which one can escalate after that because I don't want to, like,
what if you
know,
punch
I'm also
him in
like,
the face?
I know. And, like, of course, like, the other thing that's happening for me is, like, race in this moment. It's like, we're like two of the only black people around.
Right.
I don't want to have like a big thing.
Yeah.
So like that's happening in my mind, all of it. And so I sort of like after like sort of this basically like impotent moment
so frustrating.
Of hostility, I just go back to the seat that they gave me. And then.
You said you can be Vincent Cunningham.
All right, fine.
Oh, that's great.
You'll find.
That's a great.
Yeah, you'll find that it's not so great.
I love that.
I go back to my seat, and here's the crazy thing, though. After all that, the lights are going down. I see that guy and his date pop up and run down the aisle.
Like
out
literally
of the theater.
Run?
Like
scoot. Like,
they scooted.
Wow.
They did a scoot.
And to this day, I have no idea.
Wow.
What happened?
If anyone has a lead, please contact us at the mail.
The mail.
At newyorker.com.
Yeah.
Subject line, critics.
Welcome to Critics at Large, a podcast from The New Yorker. I'm Vincent Cunningham.
I'm Alex Schwartz.
And I'm Nomi Fry. Each week on this show, we make sense of what's happening in the culture right now and how we got here. Today, we're going to be talking about The Long Tail of one of my favorite novels of all time, The Talented Mr. Ripley by Patricia Highsmith. I actually realized I was trying to think when I started reading the Ripley books, and I realized it was weirdly while I was pregnant with my daughter, who is almost 13. So I read these five novels in like quick succession, you know, because they're like beautifully constructed thrillers. And I was like, what's going to happen next? What's going to happen next with this character? But my favorite remains The first one, and which is the, you know, the absolute classic that is The Talented Mr. Ripley. And we have these two guys, Dickie Greenleaf, who is this rich trust fund kid living the good life in Italy, and Tom Ripley, who's sent to Italy by Dickie's father to retrieve him, and then decides that he actually wants Dickie's life, murders him, and becomes him. And I know you guys hadn't read the book before this week. True. Right? What did you, like it?
Oh, I hugely enjoyed this novel. I gobbled it right up, ate it with a spoon, and it nicely defied my expectations, which we will be talking about shortly, which were set by the 1999 film adaptation, and which turns out to be very unlike this novel.
Yes, definitely. We'll discuss it. How about you, Vincent?
Yeah, I did like it. I was also surprised by it, especially its like its mode of narration. We'll get into this, but it's just like at first seemed like it wasn't my style, and it just grew on me in the way that a doppelganger might.
Oh.
So it was really, I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, I mean, I really think I would have been really surprised if you guys had said, you know what, I didn't like this book, because there's just something so captivating about it. And I feel like culture feels the same way, because Ripley just keeps showing up.
Dickie Greenleaf?
Who's that?
It's Tom. Tom Ripley.
Tom Ripley?
We were at Princeton together.
Okay. Did we know each other?
Hello. Well, I knew you, so I suppose you must have known me.
There's the Anthony Minghella adaptation that you mentioned, Alex. And then there's the 1960 film Purple Noon, starring Alain Delon.
Oh, yeah.
C'est bien que je l'aime, ma petite Marge, et que je l'abandonnerai jamais pour suivre le vilain monsieur que papa m'a envoyé.
Which is also an adaptation of the book. There's the much maligned and also much obsessed over film Saltburn.
You all right?
Yeah, I've got a flat tire.
Take my bike.
Hey, that is so kind. Thank you. I'm sorry I don't know your name. I'm Felix.
Oliver.
Oliver. Oliver, I love you.
I
love you. All right, cheers, Ollie.
That is kind of a modern take on the Ripley story. And, you know, to top it all off, there's a new adaptation just out on Netflix, starring Andrew Scott, the hot priest from Fleabag, as Ripley. It's an 8-part series.
He came to Italy, moved into Dickie's house. He just wouldn't go away.
You like art, Tom? You're in the right place.
You like art, Tom? Well, you're in the right place.
Tom is one of those people who takes advantage.
Okay, so today we are going to do a deep dive into the character of Tom Ripley, who he is, and why nearly 70 years after this novel was first published, we're still obsessed with this figure. So many things we're interested in as a culture are contained within Tom Ripley. You know, there's the class aspect, the kind of like a class aspirationalism.
Americans in Europe.
Americans in Europe.
The eternal appeal of the European life to a certain kind of American get about.
Yeah.
That's right, yeah. And also like an obsession with images. You know, this is
totally.
Like, it's like such a frank love of beauty that turns into a kind of like malevolent envy, you know?
No, totally. And it's like also like watching someone like spending the summer in Capri on Instagram and wanting to murder them.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Mm-hmm. I feel real now.
Okay.
That's right.
So that's today on Critics at Large, why we want what Ripley has. Okay, you guys, so let's start at the beginning with the Patricia Highsmith novel before we turn to adaptations and so on. Maybe one of you wants to give me a kind of like synopsis and then we can talk impressions.
I'm ready to try.
Okay, yes, Alex.
I'm like a Ripley, but for synopsis. I will literally kill anyone who stands in my way of synopsizing. I know.
Do it.
All right. So here's the deal.
Yes.
Tom Ripley is a 25-year-old living in New York City. Doesn't quite know what his life is about. Doesn't quite know what track he's on in life.
An orphan.
an orphan, that's right.
Mm-hmm.
He is approached one night in a bar by Herbert Richard Greenleaf, the boat-building father of one Dickie Greenleaf, another 25-year-old American, who finds himself in Mongibello.
Mongibello,
a beautiful town on the Amalfi Coast by Naples. What is Dickie doing there? According to his father, he's wasting his life. He's taken up painting. He seems to be socializing with a young American woman called Marge. Herbert wants Dickie to come back and resume the responsibilities into which he's been born. And for that purpose, he sends Tom, who has a very, very passing acquaintance with Dickie. They met maybe at a couple of parties a number of years ago, off to Italy with an expense account and an allowance in order to convince Dickie to return. Does this work? It fails miserably, but Tom makes a few interesting decisions along the way. The first is to reveal to Dickie almost immediately, as soon as he meets him, that he has been sent by his father so that the two of them can have this kind of bond in rejecting the responsibility that they're supposed to be assuming. He also hates Marge on sight, detests this woman, despises her, thinks she's absolutely disgusting, vile, a complete distraction for Dickie, who he idolizes and very much adores. What happens at this juncture? Well, it all goes downhill from there if you're Dickie, and uphill if you're Ripley, because, because Dickie soon tires of Ripley's company. Marge has never liked him from the start. He's clinging to them. He moves in with Dickie in his nice house. He's taking all his stuff. It very much does seem like he's a grifter, just there to collect daddy's checks and hang out. And in a cold moment of semi-calculated fury, Tom Ripley whacks literally Dickie over the head with a boat oar outside San Remo, murders him, sinks his bloody boat, and at this point begins a very canny kind of constantly developing scheme to impersonate him and take over his life, to wear his clothes, to wear his rings, to sell off the beautiful objects in his home, to pocket that money. This goes on and on. He gets increasingly tangled in a web of lies of his own creation, living this double Ripley Greenleaf life until finally he gives the slip and manages to make off, spoiler alert here, with Dickie's inheritance.
Alex, that was, as usual, masterful.
Fantastico.
Fantastico.
I'm just obsessed at this point with Ripley.
You know, I think what you might share with Ripley is a great attention to detail. Because I think one of the main lessons that we can learn from Tom Ripley is that keeping your story straight is an art in itself.
That is, you're putting your finger on something that stresses me out about this book beyond all measure.
Okay, yes.
Which is, it, so much of it is the mechanics of lying and how difficult it is, as you say, to keep your story straight. And Highsmith is really fascinated and obsessed with, okay, now I'm in another bind, now I'm in another pickle. Like, it's not just getting rid of the body and getting rid of the boat. It's also how to cash the checks. Oh, God, a signature seems, they've noticed that the signature is forged. Well, how to deal with that issue? It, leading a criminal life is no breeze.
No, totally.
What I, you know, maybe conversely, what I was struck by in this issue of honesty and dishonesty is how the best liar can weaponize the truth. Like Alex mentioned this, that the gambit is that Tom tells the story to Dickie about why he's there. You know,
right,
like
that the father sent him over.
That the father sent him over and gave him money, tells the truth about why he's there with the idea that, listen, if this guy's ever going to be interested in me, maybe it's the truth that works. So it is a manipulation, but by way of telling the truth. And what I love about it is that then what he says is, I told the story again to Marge, making it as funny as possible. Like the on some level, it's a it's kind of almost about Highsmith's technique of narration, which is like it's not the what but the how. The lie is about style,
right? Right.
You know, and it's it just so happens that Tom Ripley's obsession is style. Alex is correct that he idolizes and adores Dickie, but at the very beginning, when he finds him, he's disappointed. Dickie is like an amateur painter, and he's disappointed by how bad he is at painting. He's disappointed even at like his skills as a conversationalist. And what he says is like, I wanted more from Dickie Greenleaf.
Dickie is a type. He's a type. He's an entitled American who takes himself seriously in some ways. He really thinks about his art quite a lot, even if he's a complete dilettante when it comes to the actual painting. Mm-hmm. And Tom comes to think, hey, I can perform this role better than you can.
Yes.
If only, and this is where some of the class issue comes in. It's not, it is about a certain kind of class jealousy, but it's also about a sense of, hey, I can actually do this better than you can. I just need a little bit of a boost getting there. But then I'm going to have the style. I'm mm-hmm. going to have the finesse. I'm mm-hmm. going to have the panache to pull all of this off. And I actually, you're kind of soft and you don't really understand what you've been given, but I'm going to be able to enjoy these things.
Do you think that's one of the themes, this idea of reinvention, kind of the classic American trope of Gatsby and so on? Is that one of the things that you feel like make Ripley a character that's still kind of attractive to us as a trope?
Yeah, I think that there is, even outside of the like actual murders that happen in this book.
Forget the murders.
Are spectacular and yeah. whatever. It's just true that like, you know, at least in the sort of classic sense, in order to change your station in life, mm-hmm. in order to change whatever it is, class, sort of aesthetics of class, the material fact of class, whatever mm-hmm. it is, mm-hmm. that like a sacrifice must be made. You know, like
that's really
money makes you different than the people that you were born to.
Yes.
And on some level, you are like killing the person that you were before. So do many other things. Art makes you different than the people that you were born with. Education yeah. does.
Yes.
All the things that Tom is obsessed with.
Yeah.
Certain levers of refinement.
Yeah,
right?
yeah. And that refinement yeah. continues in the sequels as well. Like the sort of like continued refinement of Ripley and his turning into someone completely different than his beginnings
yeah.
in terms of like class and kind of aspiration culture. But it definitely begins here. And I love what you said about the kind of like the killing of your previous self, whether sure. metaphorically or literally. In a minute, we're finally going to hear Vincent's definitive take on the film that terrorized and enticed audiences, Saltburn. Critics at Large, we'll be right back.
The run through of Vogue is where you'll meet all the most exciting people in fashion and culture.
I am Fran Lebowitz, who should be the mayor of New York.
We all support
yeah,
that.
Yeah, we support that.
Very nice.
Nikki.
Yes.
It's been really great she being in this beautiful pink room.
All right, Usher, can you hear us?
I can hear you.
All right.
Can you hear me?
We can.
We can.
All right, here we are.
On the podcast, you'll learn how Vogue really works.
Sometimes we'll come in for a second or even third run through until we are AWOK.
Can you tell us what AWOK means?
It means AWOK, Anna Wintour OK.
I'm Cho Minardi.
And I'm Chloe Mel.
And we're the hosts of The Run Through with Vogue, where fashion and culture collide.
Join us. It's AWOK.
Listen and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
Okay, you guys. So we've been talking about Ripley, the Highsmith original novel. But as I said earlier, this novel is just the beginning because it's been adapted several times.
So many times.
Since it was published in 1955. And Ripley himself has also become a kind of archetype in culture. And I feel like even if you haven't read the actual book, you've probably still encountered the story in kind of broader strokes. Did you encounter Ripley before actually reading the book? Alex, I believe you
have
something to say?
Well, for years, Ripley for me was Matt Damon, a 1999 Matt Damon, mm-hmm. that chiseled, slim little face.
This chiseled and slim.
Going
Those horn-rimmed glasses,
going chin dimple to chin dimple with Jude Law.
That's right.
In Anthony Minghella's mm-hmm. The Talented Mr. Ripley. I mean, it was a dimple off.
Yeah. You always type your letters? That should be two T's.
I can't write and I can't spell. It's the privilege of a first-class education.
Your room's upstairs at the back. I think Ermelinda made up the bed. Ermelinda!
Sì? È tutto pronto.
Grazie.
This is so good of you.
Don't say it again.
Let's face it, it was just like, it was sex offender Harvey Weinstein's, Miramax's, you know, greatest achievement, potentially.
Yeah, I actually think I could, I think I would agree with that, Naomi. I recently rewatched the movie. It's a delightful movie, particularly the first hour. I mean, I really want to try to, for some reason, divide the entire population into two. Mm-hmm. You know, could it be said there is a kind of person who prefers Ripley before Dickie is killed and the kind who prefers after? Like, I love the beginning of that movie because I like seeing the good turn to evil.
I mean, listen. I just sorry to
level with us here.
Interject at this moment in time, but you know my memory of the movie, which I watched, you know, way long ago, like at least a decade, if not two ago, was that I did not like it.
Interesting.
Compared to the novel, it seemed to me so like corny and obvious. And as you know, I despise Jude Law's pork pie hat. And the you know I think the jazz, I think the you know the kind of like. The overtness of the kind of jazz subplot that they kind of connect over their love of jazz, which is something that, you know, that does not exist.
Has nothing to do with the novel.
Has nothing to do with
the novel. Yeah, Minghella gives Dickie a love of jazz
as opposed to painting.
Instead of painting. That's right.
This is the best. Baker, Rollins. Mark says she likes jazz, but she thinks Glenn Miller's jazz.
I never said that.
Perry Como. Bird, that's jazz. Bird, ask me the name of my sailboat.
I don't know. What's the name of your sailboat?
Look! Look! Bird!
Which is ridiculous. Boats are female. Everyone knows you can't call a boat after a man.
It just seemed to me kind of the bad thing about this adaptation, which was it made some of the more subtle ideas of the novel much more overt, which makes sense because it's a movie. And, you know, rewatching it, it's just a bit more simple.
Yeah. I think that's right.
Yeah.
And it itself is a bit of a Ripley in that it needs to, it feels the need, the movie itself feels the need to fabricate and kind of add on to the Ripley story.
Yes.
There is a local Italian woman who Dickie gets pregnant, doesn't exist in the book.
Right.
There's a whole other character played by Kate Blanchett, doesn't exist in the book. Marge is totally different than she is in the book in a way I kind of enjoy. In the book, she really is, you know, dull as dirt. And
she's kind of a misogynist fantasy.
She's a misogynist fantasy. Yeah. And specifically, I have to say, she's a gay misogynist fantasy, which is that, like, this person serves no use. Even the use of sex is, you know, disgusting when associated with
her.
Sort of
dowdy, breasty,
right.
Disgusting woman.
A disgusting woman.
It's a very funny, it's a very funny misogynist take, but,
well, it
you
also
know.
Is fascinating because Patricia Highsmith was many things. You know, she was a snail aficionado. She was a virulent anti-Semite,
That's
but
right.
she was also lesbian.
Yeah.
And so it is interesting, or it was interesting to me to think while reading the book about her getting so deep into the character of Tom Ripley that this hatred of this woman and this hatred for the female form especially can come through so powerfully.
Can you please say more about the snails?
Yes, I'm sorry to just drop it in there. I mean, I think the virulent anti-Semite part speaks for itself. but yeah, she did love snails and was fascinated by snails. I believe this goes back to a moment early in her life when she saw two snails mating and observed that it could not be told which one of them was male or female, that they really just like, as she did, she very much identified with this kind of you know, masculine quality. She felt sometimes that she had been put in the wrong body and, you know.
And she carried snails in her purse on a head of lettuce.
She was snails were kind of, you know, what the peacock was to Flannery O'Connor, snails were to Patricia Highsmith.
Yeah. But Alex, moving on from snails and from the Anthony Minghella adaptation.
I do apologize.
There is another adaptation that you are a fan of, I believe, from 1960, directed by Renee Clément.
Okay.
And so, starring Alain Delon as Ripley in his first major role.
Yeah. If you guys want primo Alain Delon, and who doesn't? If we're all honest with
you,
you know, whoever you are, whatever you're into, I think we can all get down with Alain Delon's face in the year 1960, right? Like, you know, which is to say nothing of his torso shown to great advantage in this film. So this film is called Purple Noon. I'm just going to say something about this film, which is that French people play Americans. It makes zero sense in the most wonderful way. The first word of the movie is the word voila, okay?
Monsieur est en mission envoyée par papa de San Francisco pour me récupérer et toucher 5000 dollars à la livraison.
We're getting this kind of great refracted Ripley thing, but there are things I love about the movie and I really recommend it to everyone. So just to focus on the character of Ripley, like in the Minghella version, this is a really high-flying Ripley, very different also than in the novel where he's recessive and kind of a lurker. Here we have a very happy, outgoing, fun in the sun kind of Ripley. There is a lot of physical touch between him and the character of Philippe, who is the Dickie Greenleaf character. Like, I would say that the gay subtext is most overt in the Minghella movie, where we see Matt Damon's Ripley falling asleep on Jude Law's Dickie in the train, trying to get physically close to him. The actual murder takes place in a moment of great distress and rejection. None of that is really true, both in the book and in Purple Noon. Like, it's not Ripley, but it's a great kind of, like, speaking of jazz, it's a great kind of, like, jazzy riff on Ripley. You gotta see it.
Improvisation on its theme.
Okay, so one occasion for this episode is the latest adaptation of The Talented Mr. Ripley. Netflix has just released a brand new Ripley called simply Ripley, starring Andrew Scott, a.k.a. Fleabag's hot priest. I'm just going to go ahead and say something.
Say your piece, Naomi. We've got to hear it.
Okay, Ripley in the novel is 25, correct? God love Andrew Scott. Handsome, you know, robust, you know, still a prime of his years man. However, the whole idea of Ripley, and I think part of, like, the sort of malleability of him and his ability to kind of take on these other characters, and is that he is a young man, right? Yeah. And here in this new adaptation, he is a man in his 40s.
Late 40s.
And I'm like, what is this choice?
Vincent, can I venture an answer?
Yes, please.
And I think this speaks to the richness of Highsmith's initial text, that you can make a Ripley that is about something that is totally separate from a different adaptation.
Okay.
It's like it is a riff on totally separate themes from, for example, the 1999 Damon film.
Yes.
That movie, the 1999 Minghella film, is obsessed with what we've already talked about, which is Ripley's obsession with beauty.
Yes.
That movie only works because every single person in it is hot. I first knew of Ripley. The only reason I knew, like, what this film looked like is because the pictures of Damon and Jude Law are often, very often used in men's blogs, menswear blogs.
Oh, interesting.
Here is an example of Ivy preppy style. And here is an example of something sort of continental and exotic. It's a movie
That's
all
so
about appearances and beauty, right? Whereas this new adaptation, which is directed and written by Steven Zaillian, who has worked with Martin Scorsese a lot, is, I think, all about the psychological displacement, anomie, and the, like, isolation and loneliness of the Ripley character.
Yeah.
And therefore, there's almost a kind of, like, surrealism. Part of the point is that, like, nothing kind of makes sense in his world.
Yeah.
It's black and white. It refuses you beauty.
Right.
And
is there a scene that you can, you know, that this sense of anomie and sort of almost surrealist?
Absolutely is.
Yeah.
When he gets to Italy and first finds Dickie Greenleaf on the beach, no one else is on the beach.
Dickie Greenleaf.
Yes?
Tom Ripley. From New York. We met at Bob Delancey's place. It was years ago. What a coincidence.
It's like a lonely, desiccated landscape.
Yeah.
Somebody gives him, the funny thing where somebody gives him directions, like, Sue, like, go up the stairs. He leaves the place where he gets these directions, and there's, like, a maze of stairs in every direction.
Right.
It's all about,
it's like
loneliness.
Something. Yeah.
And so it makes almost sense that he's, like, displaced even from his age or something like that.
Right. Yeah.
Okay. Well, I have something to say about this adaptation that I would just briefly like to add, which is that emptiness and that it's – I feel like the director, Steven Zaillian, basically set out to make the antithesis of the 1999 Ripley.
Yes.
That it was his need to refute that and to say, what I'm really sensing behind this adaptation is a sense of, no, I know the books better. Mm. And here is what they're all about. Because in a lot of ways, this is certainly the most faithful adaptation that Ripley has gotten yet. And it is also, I'm so sorry to say, the dullest. It really, truly is.
Yeah, I was.
And one reason for that, we have to just lay the blame.
Incredibly slow, by the way.
The eight-episode structure is a disaster. Yeah. I really want to just, I have to just say it. I got to say it. Talented Mr. Ripley needs to be fleet. It needs to move. It needs to cut.
The fleetness is so
missing.
I
don't need to see the elevator going up, the elevator sending, the elevator going up again, and then once again going down.
Yeah.
Too much. I don't need to see the elevator, period.
Yeah.
So there is a lot of so drawn-out stuff. That said, it is more faithful to the books in a very particular way, which is, I think, that quality that you're getting at, Vincent, that colorless quality. Mm-hmm. The book is not colorless, but I think we have to talk about sex, if I can just briefly put
please.
It forward.
Yes.
The 1960 Purple Noon is all about sex, but mainly about straight sex.
Yeah.
The 1999 Ripley also features a very aggressive scene of straight sex in a boat that kind of the others are made to observe between Marge and Dickie, which does not exist in the book, which disgusts, you know, Tom. And Tom has this deep queer longing. And there's also the very significant character Freddie Miles, who is played in the 1999 movie by a wonderful Philip Seymour Hoffman, playing this really foppish, really flamboyant, gay, like kind of out gay character to the closeted Ripley. And basically his purpose in that movie is to say, like, I see what you're about. You're full of shit. Like, recognize, like, I see you. And the truth of the Ripley character, as Highsmith wrote him, and I think what this new adaptation is trying to get across, is of someone whose sexuality is so repressed that he cannot access it at all. And that is what creates this sinister need for taking on someone else's life. Marge says something in a letter to Dickie in the book, which is repeated in the adaptation, which is, you know, do you guys, like, she kind of wants to know, like, is there something between you, once Dickie disappears and Ripley is pretending to be Dickie, is there something going on between you two guys?
You say he's not a bad guy, but I don't like him. How can you not see he's using you? Is he queer? I don't know. I don't think he's normal enough to have any kind of sex life.
So it's the repression that is so deep that is coming through sort of in the series. The series makes a total hash of it, in my opinion.
Yeah.
But that is a fascinating character of Ripley. And I feel like has a lot to do with Saltburn.
Yes. Yes. Now we will finally turn to Saltburn because
Saltburn.
Talking about sex, Alex, as you have, you know, brings us to Emerald Fennell's recent movie, Saltburn, currently streaming on Amazon. Vincent, do you want to lead us?
Right. So, as you mentioned, Saltburn, directed by Emerald Fennell, starring Barry Keoghan and Jacob Elordi. So it's a similar setup, you know.
Yeah. It's
Keoghan
Oxford. It's
Oxford. He plays a scholarship student, Barry Keoghan does, named Oliver and
Oliver Quick.
And Jacob Elordi plays a rich character named Felix Catton. And Oliver develops this kind of obsession with Felix, who has like extended a kind of friendship to him and sort of brought him along into this circle of chic, rich kids at Oxford. So he scores this invitation from Felix to Felix's family estate, this very gothic.
Called Saltburn.
Red staircase. I accidentally fingered my cousin here. Henry VII's cabinet. Goes to Granny. Hi, Granny. Green room, garden, some fucking hideous Rubens. Broken piano, blue room, it's blue.
This movie has been much maligned as a sort of like thin, opportunistic, sort of overly obsessed with especially sexual spectacle version of the Ripley story. What happens is that Oliver is like besotted with the lifestyle of Saltburn, and after a kind of rejection from the Felix character, kills him, and then proceeds to systematically, over a long period of time, as we realize, kill everybody else who could have any sort of claim to Saltburn, moves in, does a naked dance. You will love it, okay? No one else. So here's my thing. Here, I'm going to mount my defense of Saltburn.
Okay, we need to hear this. Because, yes. Listeners, I did not like Saltburn. I don't know what Alex thought of it.
But I could have taken the naked dance and pretty much left every other bit of it, yeah. I'd say. Although I love seeing Rosamund Pike back on the screen.
She's great.
Here's the thing. I think that the denigration of this movie depends on a radical overrating of the 1999 one. That's all it is. The 1999 Ripley.
That's really interesting.
Is
a bold claim, Vincent.
Also obsessed with surfaces and spectacle. It's a little bit more psychologically acute, but it's not that. I like the movie. Don't get me wrong. But it only works because everybody in it is hot, as I have already said.
Yeah.
And this one at least does us the sort of, it's just like all it cares about is being entertaining. Ripley 99 riffs on the themes of the Highsmith. And this is a riff just on the aesthetics and sex of the 1999. Like the way I read it.
Whoa. I just have a lot
fun.
Of questions.
I think it's fun. I watched it at the Angelica, yeah. And it was nonstop laughs and gaps and what the fucks. And I think it's a fun movie that is for sickos.
Are you a sicko, Vincent Cunningham?
Yes, I am.
All it's on the record.
On my letterbox, I called it catnip for sickos, and that's what it is.
But you know what? I feel like it's like for fake sickos.
I was about to say the same thing.
Yes!
Oh, my God. I was about to say, like, Vincent, you are just sweet as Sebastian Flight's teddy bear in Brideshead Revisited. You think you're a sicko.
I know.
I don't know.
Maybe not.
Go ahead.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I think it's a little bit for fake sickos. Naomi, tell me more about what you think.
Well, I think we've said enough.
Having branded me a fake sicko, what else would you like to say?
No, only in the best way. I just mean that
if you were a real sicko,
it is a kind of like, I mean, the term catnip is, I think, correct, because it's kind of like, I mean, I love trash, but this was trash that was trying to pretend to be.
I don't think it was trying to be.
No, but it was pretending to be transgressive, and I was like, ugh, I don't care. Like, okay, so he drinks the bathwater. Like, you know,
Who hasn't?
No, not
the bathwater
that
Jacob Elordi has jerked off into. I just want to be clear to our listeners.
Yeah, yeah. Not that I'm like some edgy. It's not. I've never, you know, I haven't, you know, like swilled bathwater would jerk off in it.
This podcast is quickly becoming a never have I ever around the bathwater scene.
But
so it's not like I'm like beyond that, but
kind of sounds like you are beyond.
Because I could sense that it was trying really hard, is what I'll say. You know, rather than being cool about it.
Fair enough. Yeah.
Well, you know, Vincent. Okay, I'm going to come clean here. Mm-hmm.
Sorry for kink shaming,
and say that. I did have fun with it. I mean, the Ripley-esque elements, just to try to bring us all back. You know, the nightmare scenario is of a guest who arrives and who never leaves. I think that is the terror of what this is all about. And Saltburn is that to a T. You know, basically to me, the point is like Ripley lives on. He's alive and well.
Yes. In a minute. Why do we still love Ripley?
Hello there, radio listeners. It's Luke Burbank, host of Livewire. Each week, we bring you riveting and unexpected conversations with the people behind some of the most interesting entertainment and culture out there today. Plus, we're going to introduce you to great music and outrageously funny comedy. And you get to hang with me and our announcer, Elena Passarello, as we talk about the best news of the week. So please, don't miss Livewire.
Okay, you guys, so why does a text from 1955 still resonate with audiences 70 years later? Like, why is it so durable?
I think there are a few things. I think one is just generally, you know, we love someone who gets away with it. I also think that the sexuality is a big part of it.
Yes.
We have here an anti-hero who is coded gay, you know, definitely as gayness, you know, non-heterosexualities have become increasingly accepted, celebrated, et cetera. There's something that's kind of, I think, like fun about the gay anti-hero. And we see it all over the place. Like, you know, I'm thinking of this latest season of White Lotus.
Yeah.
Which was set in Italy in a very Ripley-like setting, beautiful Italy, and featured the famous line, "These gays, they're trying to murder me," spoken by Jennifer Coolidge's character, who was indeed on the verge of being murdered by a bunch of gays on a boat.
In the boat, drive the boat to the shore. Please, these gays, they're trying to murder me.
Sinister gays.
Sinister gays on a boat.
We're trying to Ripley her. We're trying to take over.
They were absolutely trying to Ripley her. They were trying to take over, her life, her money, her estate. And so that was a very conscious – I'm bringing it up because it was such a conscious Ripley reference.
Mm.
And,
right.
like, playing on the taboo elements of an identity that has become less taboo over time, there's something delicious and fun about it. I think that's part of the appeal as well.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, what I think that dovetails with is you can think of non-heterosexuality, whatever its form, queerness, I guess, as a catch-all. You know, especially the way that we talk about it today, the word is identity. What is chosen, what is unchosen, what you can take with you when you change and what you can't, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that is such a big issue for us today. Whether it's about sexuality or, like, race or whatever, but also the selves that we perform as they proliferate online and everything else, what it means to be oneself, to have an identity that is, quote-unquote, real, has never been more in question.
Yeah, that's so true. And I think another aspect of this identity and emulation is when we're thinking about identity online and the figure of, like, the influencer, for instance, right?
Mm-hmm.
Where we have these people who are kind of parading their identities and what makes up their identities through, you know, the places they go to, the meals they consume, the objects they have, you know, like their lifestyle, essentially. They are kind of like the Dickie Greenleaves, in a sense, right? You know, I feel like one of the reasons that the character of Ripley is kind of like forever, in some ways, sympathetic, is the kind of yearning and striving to be something other than himself, following an example that's set out to him. And for him, it's someone like Dickie. For us, it might be someone online who's like, look at these pants I'm wearing, or look at this fish I'm eating, or look at this, like, yacht on the Amalfi Coast I'm, like, you know, on.
Nomi, that's such a good point. I think, you know, we are also susceptible to those images of what the good life looks like or could be. But when I think of those Instagram influencers, yes, there's the class that are inevitably lounging around on their yachts and everything seems very nice and good for them. But it also makes me think a bit, there was a video, I can't remember if it was last year or the year before, but I'm sure it will recirculate when Amalfi season is upon us non-Amalfiers again, of a travel influencer just complaining about how hard and annoying everything was on her trip to Italy.
Finally. Then, to get to the highest of the high points, the beautiful hotels with the gorgeous, there's no streets here. There's no cars driving. So you have to walk up 160 stairs with all of your luggage to get to the top of this gorgeous, gorgeous, gorgeous.
The effort that we actually know if we use our conscious brains goes into giving this impression of the ideal, finding the right shot, getting the right light, wearing the right outfit, all of that stuff, that is super Tom Ripley.
Yeah.
What really comes through in the Highsmith novel, it's also about work.
Oh, so
it's about working super, super, super hard to give others, but also yourself, the impression of leisure.
Yeah.
And Tom Ripley is kind of at his happiest when he's alone but not lonely and consumed with all his work. He has to, you know, write to the banks. He has to go to American Express. He's got to pick up his mail. He's got to send another fake letter home. He's got to send. He loves.
Learn Italian.
Yeah. Learn Italian. He loves the job of being an imposter. And of course, that job now is like a pretty lucrative job through social media.
That's so true.
Ripley is like totally with us in those ways.
Yeah. That's such a great. I mean, thinking about Ripley as the behind the scenes of the influencer life is such an interesting thing, you know, in the
it
sort
could be
of
a
like
consultant today.
Yeah. And the sort of very Marxist way of like, here is the substratum of, you know, the fetish that we all are looking to. Mm-hmm. This is the labor that goes into it.
It just like reminds me of like, I'm thinking about this like influencer idea and also, as I mentioned, the sort of Pinterest board approach to clothes, especially in the 1999 Ripley. And I'm just thinking about the idea of like what we call today like getting a fit off or like or used to just be called like having a look, right?
Yeah.
Where and I don't want to essentialize the past, but we think of like a point in history where clothes really spoke to your identity,
mm-hmm.
you know, like really spoke to, you know, right now I'm wearing Dickies painter jeans and I'm not a house painter. Do you know what I mean? Like,
sure.
You wear work wear and you like sort of looking, walk around looking like your grandfather who actually worked with his hands or
right.
whatever.
Yeah.
Or like, it's about like putting on an identity for a day. This look means
mm-hmm.
X,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I think, it has to do with this like looser approach that we have toward identity that you could like try this on
right.
and be this person for a day or for a summer or whatever, you know?
Yeah.
I think that is a freeing way of thinking about identity and personal style.
Yeah.
But I also do think it speaks to like a kind of unsettledness and insecurity.
Yeah.
Well, I like this point about identity because something about Ripley himself, and I think this is also what continues to resonate with people. Like, yeah, of course these books are about class, but there's something that's so much deeper than class in the books, and it goes to this question of identity and a kind of identity that doesn't have a common label. Ripley fundamentally knows, Tom Ripley knows that he is a lugubrious mm-hmm. person, that he is not someone other people want to have around.
He's a creep.
He knows. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
He's gross. And like when he has to step back into his own skin, he's grossed out. He's gotten so used to being the other guy and knowing what it is. He just loves being alone as Dickie, as this other guy. He loves not being himself. This is something that's way deeper than a social label. This is about personality and persona. Can you change yours? And one of the reasons that this novel endures and its adaptation endures is that that is an eternal human question. It doesn't matter what the political situation you're living in is or the, you know, society right. you're living in is. Can you change your fundamental nature? Like that's really, I think, the question of these books. And Ripley's answer is basically no, but I can find an arrangement that lets me really have a lot more fun with it than I was before.
Yeah. I mean, that's fun is such a that's why I think I didn't really relate to this new adaptation, the Netflix one, because mm-hmm. it's so unfun.
It's studiously unfun.
Yeah.
It's like deeply unfun.
See, this is why I like this. Justice for this adaptation, also justice for Saltburn. I think that's
so
the point of it. Is it like
because they're so different from each other as well. So
that's
it's,
right.
Yeah.
It's like, yeah, exactly. They're the opposite ends of the spectrum, right? But I think it's about how unfun it is to be lost and how therefore
right.
even fun, the attempt at fun,
yes.
becomes to the point we've been making, like its own kind of labor.
Yes.
You know what I mean? And too much work.
Would you agree to be a house guest at Saltburn? That's what I want to know.
As I recall, there's there's a black guy who gets off pretty much scot-free. I think I'd be fine. isn't that correct?
I mean, he is
he's
set
like
up
a cousin
for theft and then banished.
Oh, that's
but,
right.
like, he definitely gets away with his life.
He doesn't die. I'm less refined and chic than that person. But I, unlike Barry Keoghan / Oliver Quick, I'm a beautiful house guest. And the thing about me is
I
try to leave first so that they'll ask me back later.
Before the murders begin?
Before the murders begin,
mm-hmm.
after the cocktails are done.
Mm-hmm.
That's my sweet spot.
Classy.
Amazing. This has been Critics at Large. Our senior producer is Rhiannon Corby, and Alex Barish is our consulting editor. Our executive producer is Stephen Valentino. Condé Nast's head of global audio is Chris Bannon. Alexis Quadrado composed our theme music, and we had engineering help today from Jake Loomis, with mixing by Mike Kutchman. You can find every episode of Critics at Large at newyorker.com/critics, and you can email us at themail@newyorker.com with the subject line, Critics. See you next Thursday.
We've all been there before. You're planning a dinner party or having family over or even just cooking for yourself when all of a sudden it starts to feel overwhelming.
I live in a very small one-bedroom apartment with a very small kitchen.
I can't figure out what to serve besides water soup at this point.
I'm Chris Morocco, food director of Bon Appetit and Epicurious, and this is Dinner SOS, a new podcast from Bon Appetit. Maybe it's a last-minute party with no menu inspiration, a kitchen with no space, a toddler who will only eat buttered pasta. Name your dinner emergency. We're here to help. Here's how the show works. On each episode, we'll take a call from a home cook facing a real dinner emergency. Then, I'll work with one of our editors or someone from our amazing test kitchen to try and solve it. Because cooking for the people you love should inspire joy without a side of stress. Make sure you're following Dinner SOS wherever you're listening now.